From KMUW Wichita.
From Toronto, Ontario.
And from Armia, Spain.
This is You're Saying It Wrong. Let's talk words. Let's talk words. Let's talk literary words. Sometimes authors just make stuff up. I'm Fletcher Powell, host and producer at KMUW in Wichita, Kansas. And joining me, as they do each week, language experts and New York Times bestselling authors, Kathy Petras and Ross Petras. Well, hello there, Ross Petras. I see more of your room now there at your home in Toronto. Not just all of your wonderful old books, but also a lamp. You've zoomed out.
I have a lamp. I have zoomed out. Yeah, my old camera I hated. So now I've got a wonderful new camera, so you don't have a huge Ross head dominating the screen. I was horrified looking at that last video. So now
I was going to say, apropos of the lamp, Ross has always been very bright.
Yes, that.
Okay, of course. Moving along right now.
That, of course, Kathy Petras, there at your home in Armia. You were telling me a moment ago.
Which hasn't changed.
Well, it has a bit, because you tell me spring is in the air now there in Armia, finally.
Spring is in my itchy eyes, too.
Well, yeah, that too. Yeah.
Yes, it is spring and sunny and lovely, so I'm a happy woman.
I'm a happy man, because we are going to be talking today about some authors and some words that have originated in literature. But I know that we have a listener question to jump off with first.
Okay. It was an email from Katie in Virginia who asks, you talked about why different plurals are spelled differently. We're not the beeves, I'm assuming she's referring to.
More than one beef being beeves.
The
yes.
beeves. And now I'm wondering, why are some past tenses also spelled differently, like burnt, slept, dreamt? And then she said, okay, that one is also dreamed, ED.
Okay, that's interesting, actually. And we have a really complicated statement from a quote from a linguistics book. From a linguistics and phonetics standpoint, in a majority of cases, the suffix T as a formative of past participles of verbs appeared as a result of the reduction of ED to D and then the devocalization of D. That sounds really cool, doesn't it? What does that mean? that's like a great explanation if you're a linguist. The key thing is this. I mean, let's just try it with Fletcher. Let's use the word nip. Fletcher, what's the past tense of nip?
Nipped. And it sounds like a T there, right?
You bet. And it changes basically from the D to what's called devocalization. The T, when you don't like use your vocal cords, the D sounds like T, and that's what happened. And in some cases, it's spelled, we don't spell nipped, N-I-P-T, but in a lot of other cases, we do spell other words like she just said. Burnt is B-U-R-N-T, slept is S-L-E-P-T, etc.
That's interesting, especially with like burnt, because I think I often even say burned. I burned the...
I do.
You do.
I do too. Yeah, I just thought of, because you say like, oh, wow, you got really sunburned.
Exactly.
Sunburnt.
Sometimes. Sometimes you could say like you got... sometimes there are slight nuances. You might say you got really sunburned or I'm really burnt. Do you know what I mean? There's a different feel there.
Burnt is more like an adjective for me, like burnt toast.
Yes, right.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's what happens sometimes. The one key thing to remember, and that's why the ED sometimes supersedes the T. That T ending is older. And a lot of times, because the ED is sort of a standard English past tense ending, a lot of times the T... kind of, we dumped the T and went back to the ED. Mm-hmm. So that happens a lot.
I remember sometime back we were talking about past tense and we were talking about this T and ED sound. And I'm reminded that when my daughter, I mean, she's still learning the language, she's young, but when she was learning sort of past tense and how to create past tense, you know, just through the course of interacting with us and learning language, she would add an ED even onto like a past tense because she knew the ED needed to be there. So like she would say, I jumped instead of I jumped.
That is so fascinating, and it's so true. It's really interesting. I mean, that goes back to this great linguistic idea that we all have, like Chomsky had it and all that. We have like an internal grammatical sense, and we create algorithms in our head. Our parents don't teach them how to speak. The kids learn how to speak.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And she did. You didn't say, you know, like, now, ED right. is your past tense ending, daughter.
Right.
You
know,
he might have done that, Ross.
I mean, I can't be sure.
Yeah.
But she glommed onto that idea, and mm-hmm. it's perfect. And then basically what happens later is she goes, wait a minute, jump to, it doesn't seem to work. They look kind of puzzled. I'm going to can the next, you know, the last AED. And that's what they did.
Yeah.
Right.
It's really cool.
All right. Shall we move on?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's jump into these literature originated words. Tell me what in the world we're doing here.
Okay, we're calling it Who Gets the Credit? Why do I always sound like I'm at like some sideshow in a local fair? But anyway.
Carnival Barker over there.
It's like a lot. We're talking about words. A lot of times they come. We've talked about this in the past. How many words come into English from writers like Shakespeare, of course. Mm. We've talked about Lewis Carroll, I think, a couple of Dickenses.
Well, even a week or two ago, we talked about Tolkien and dwarves instead of dwarfs, right?
Right.
Exactly.
And also, before we start, Fletcher, do you know the world or English champion of who gave us the most words? Which writer?
Oh, I would have figured Shakespeare.
John Milton.
Oh,
I was
going to
say Milton.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you guys like Milton? I never cared for Milton.
I can't stand him. I tried to like him. But I couldn't. Although I have an edition of printed in 1715 of Milton, or somewhere in there, Milton in Latin, which is the absolute most useless book I think I have in my collection.
Does it have his illustrations, which I also didn't care for?
I didn't care for those either. No, it doesn't.
Okay.
Well, moving along.
You guys just brought up this topic so you could rag on Milton for the entire hour.
So shall we? The first word is hard-boiled, as in hard-headed, a hard-boiled. Was it invented by Raymond Chandler, first appearing in Pick Up on Noon Street, Jane Austen in her unfinished novel Sanditon, or Mark Twain in a speech given in San Francisco?
Oh, wow. That's good. Those are good choices. Okay, so now I see what we're doing here. I've got a word. You're giving me authors to choose from. Who created this word and gave it to us? Well, we all often talk about the hard-boiled detective. I don't really assume it came from Chandler, so I'm going to drop him off. Jane Austen is always a good answer, but for some reason I think it's Mark Twain here. It's Mark Twain.
Ross?
Here's the problem. Kind of. This was sort of a cheat.
In, oh, right out of the gate, you're cheating me. Okay, here we go.
Okay, we always do that. We have to. But the key thing here is it's usually attributed to Mark Twain. And this is, again, a little illustration of some of the problems of, like, you know, assigning word origins or whatever. I mean, we have here the term first documented as being used by Mark Twain in 1886 as an adjective meaning hardened, which is true. But in the sense, he's really doing it more in the sense of like a language being hardened. So it doesn't really quite fit what we typically... Well, he was using it as hidebound, like hidebound grammar is what he was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, they have it literally, a hard-boiled, hidebound grammar was a statement.
Okay.
And that is not really the type of thing we're thinking of. So we looked back on the, you know, the trusty OED, and we found actually this really good case from the 1884, 2 years before Twain or Mr. Samuel Clemens. And I think this is more of the definition. They would far rather see at the head of affairs a less perfect Christian and a hard-boiled man of the world of the type of Palmerston. And I think that really counters what we were talking. I mean, I think that counters the Twain argument.
So it's often attributed to Twain, but probably it came around before him.
Yeah, yes. Possibly. Yeah. I mean, the one problem is things are in the zeitgeist. They're in the ether. beforehand. And a lot of times, you know, we're basically looking at what's written down, who right. said what. But a lot of times, obviously, Twain may have heard someone else saying it, you know, et cetera.
Although they have it right there. I think that the problem is that people know Mark Twain and they don't bother looking up the fact that this was written in
right.
the Times in February, mm-hmm. On February 11th, 1884.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know? I agree with you. I don't normally read old time, you know, Times and stuff, and I might read Twain. You're right.
Yeah, I think that's more the thing. And it's also easier. And, you know, the internet, once it's picked up, it gets repeated.
Yeah, it's really
remarkable. Even if it's not true. Because I don't think that Twain example really is it. Because Hard Boiled is Hard Boiled. I mean, it's like the old noir movies when they go, you know, I've heard about Hard Boiled. You're 5 minutes. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, completely. And I mean, Hard Boiled. And if you said Hard Boiled grammar, I would picture basically a noir grammar.
Right.
You know,
right,
of some sort.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
I don't quite
yeah.
know what would it be, but I would picture like, yeah, he looked up, you know, that sort of thing.
Okay.
Okay. The next one is Catch 22.
Oh, right.
Here's the question. Now, we know, you know what Catch 22 is. It's the World War II novel.
The Joseph Heller. Uh-huh.
Yeah. I always love that. You know, Orr would be crazy to fly more missions insane if he didn't. But if he was sane, he had to fly them. If he flew them over Germany, he was crazy and didn't have to. But if he didn't want to, he was sane and had to. Basically, you can't win.
Right.
Now, the question we have here was the original, this is like extremely vital, Fletcher. This is literary, this is vital. The term Catch-22, which we now use for that sort of dilemma where neither side is good. Mm-hmm. Catch-22, one, was a Catch-47, two, or was the original title Catch-18?
Ah, heck. Oh, they both, oh man, I was going with 47 until you said 18. Now I'm not positive. shoot.
We've talked about this in the past.
Yeah, and I've read this somewhere too. If all you had said was, is Catch 22 the original number, I would have said, no, of course not. But what is it? I will go with 47, even though I'm not sure now. 47.
Oh, boy, were you... You were right. Listen to your gut.
I was so close. I mean, 47 was my gut.
It was 18.
Okay. Catch 18. Why did? Do you know why he changed?
Actually, the working title was Catch 18. But when it was getting ready for publication, there was another war novel that had recently come out by Leon Uris.
Oh, Mila 18.
Called Mila or Mila. I'm
yeah,
not sure what it was.
I was
18.
I was, that was Mila. Yeah.
What I loved about that was they quoted, Heller quoted, 11 didn't work because of Ocean's 11. And then he goes, 14 was an unfunny number. 26 didn't feel right. I've got it. It's Catch 22, said Gottlieb, the editor. It's funnier than 18, too. Now, that's what really gets me. Like, it sort of got it, too. Do you guys think, Catch 14 doesn't sound very funny to me either.
No, it doesn't. Catch 22 is way funnier.
Yeah.
It's got a better rhythm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the old thing. Some words and some numbers are funnier than others, and there's no reason.
I know,
I agree. Yeah. Catch 47's not bad, I don't think.
I don't think it's bad.
Our next word is doormat. Now, we're saying this not as a literal doormat, but as a metaphor applied to a person upon whom other people, quote, wipe their boots.
Uh-huh.
Now, did this first originate with William Shakespeare in Taming of the Shrew, Jonathan Swift in Gulliver's Travels, or Charles Dickens in Great Expectations?
This is a toughie, actually.
I don't want to say Shakespeare. It's funny how often I'm not going to want to say Shakespeare, even though Shakespeare gave us a whole lot of words.
Just not as much as John Milton.
Yeah, exactly. I've learned. How about Dickens? Why not? Let's go with Dickens.
You got it.
All right.
She asked me and Joe whether we supposed she was doormats under our feet and how we dared use her so, and what company we graciously thought she was fit for.
Yeah.
Interesting enough that we said doormat right now. Do we think, I don't really think it's a modern term. I wouldn't use doormat anymore.
You're such a doormat? No, not really.
I wouldn't. What about you, Fletcher?
I don't know if I've ever used it.
He's a real doormat.
Yeah, probably not. What would you say instead?
I don't know. He doesn't stick up for himself. He's really, I don't know. I don't think I would
He's
ever.
Such a doormat. I think you might. I have like a sub question here.
Sorry, I didn't interrupt you for a second. I just looked up synonyms for doormat. I got welcome mat.
He's such a freaking welcome mat.
I know what
mat,
it is. I'm going to throw it in pushover.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Pushover.
Wimp, pushover, jellyfish.
Jellyfish.
Jellyfish is not a doormat. Jellyfish is a very different thing to me. I wanted to say, speaking of Dickens, and this came up last night, I was out with my little writers group, and somebody said something about Charles Dickens, I kid you not, and then somebody else said, well, obviously, that speaking of, oh, what the Dickens? We're talking about old phrases that you don't use. And someone said, well, obviously, that is from Charles Dickens.
No.
Okay, that's what I was just going to ask. What the Dickens? Which no one ever says yeah, now. Where do you think it came from?
Interesting. I've never question it because no one says it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also...
Well, we're really getting really useful today.
But I've also never thought it came from Charles Dickens. Why would it?
Yeah, that's what I thought.
I mean, maybe because I think of like little imps, right? Little Dickens. Oh, you're a little Dickens.
Oh, that's interesting.
I never heard that in my life, but I like
it. Oh, really? Like a kid? I mean, it's not like, again, people don't really say it that much, but... It doesn't sound weird to me, the little Dickens. Or also...
Oh, that little Dickens.
Also, something scared the Dickens out of me, right?
I've heard that.
Yeah, that I've heard.
I've never used it, but we sound like we're all like 99 years old here.
Well, we're giving, if anyone wants to go time travel, we're giving them a lot of ammunition. They're not going to be out of place.
Yeah, I did not expect this kind of deep dive on Dickens in the episode.
There's some thought that it was a substitute for the devil.
Okay,
that makes sense to me.
Well, that would be the little Dickens thing, right? The little little imp.
Yeah, little devils. Yeah, uh-huh. That would make sense to me too. And then the other one is really weird. Kathy, you want to tell the other one? I think that was insane.
Oh, it relates to like a person named Dickens or Dixon who made wooden bowls.
Yeah.
Kept losing money.
Yeah.
Giving them as Dickens. No, that I don't think
it's
so.
Devil.
But you never
it's
know. But it could also be a double, you know, etymology. It could be initially from that and then people then, you know, sort of transmogrify the meaning to meaning the devil. That's the weird thing about all of this. We don't really, you know, we don't have tape recorders and people to talk to it.
Shakespeare had it more as devil, and I'm with Will.
I agree.
He and I are like this.
I think that's it. I think that's it.
So now we're going to move on to a different word, which I think we do use, fortunately. At least we're getting a little more modern. Serendipity. Now, the question we have for you there... Which is, you well know, the making happy and unexpected discoveries.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually fairly rare before the 20th century. It was coined by writer Horace Walpole in a letter to Horace Mann, but it was not published until 1833, if you'd like to know that. But anyway, did Mr. Walpole get this from the Latin serenitatum, serenitas, clearness, which gives us the word serenity, the Persian word serendip, meaning the country of Sri Lanka, or the Italian and Spanish serenata, a music sung or played in the streets to celebrate someone.
I've heard of serendip, but I always assumed it was associated with serendipity somehow, so I'll go with that one. But I can't imagine that's right. That seems like the most obvious one.
You got it.
Oh, it is. Great.
You got it. You're very good.
Well, do you know how he made that leap from the name of the place to this idea?
There was a Persian story, The Three Princes of Serendip, referring to Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
And it was translated into English, and Serendip was an old Persian word for Sri Lanka, which comes actually from the Sanskrit, which I unfortunately don't know too much about, but I think the dip part is island, which indeed Sri Lanka is a big island, and the Seren part is lion, I think, in Sanskrit. So it's like the island of the lions. And it was a really, Sri Lanka is like really fertile, really a pleasant land, so everyone liked the idea of it. And there were a lot of books, interestingly enough, we collect books, as you can see behind you, and we have a lot of them. And it was a really big thing in the 1700s in Europe. People would go there or talk about it. It was like sort of the land to go to. And they loved this Persian fairy tale as well.
Mm-hmm.
Walpole came up with the word serendipity from the Persian serendip or serendib, because the heroes of the fairy tale, as he wrote, he said they were always making discoveries by accident. So it's like they'd be walking down the street and, whoa, something incredible's happening.
Cool.
So that's where the word came
that's
from.
That's fun. Yeah.
I thought so too. Well, I love fairy tales. So I was like, that's a goodie.
Yeah.
The next one's easy. If you don't get this, Fletcher, Ross and I are never speaking to you again.
Oh, no. Yep. Okay.
Chortle.
Oh, yes.
To laugh or chuckle when amused or pleased, or to sing and chant exultantly. I don't think that's really.
I want to talk about that when we're done with this.
He chortled in his joy. Was that
But actually, I think he did have. Whatever. We're giving it away. Who said it? One.
Yeah, it's from Jabberwocky.
I think we just gave it away. Lewis Carroll and Through the Looking Glass.
Right. It's from Jabberwocky.
Yes. Yes, it is. He chortled in his joy.
Yes.
I loved Jabberwocky when I was a kid. I mean, I still do, but it's not like I've read it for a long time. But I used to go around reciting that thing when I was in like fourth grade, and I'm sure no one cared and it was really annoying. But I was that kind of kid, darn it, and I loved it.
I'm with you, baby.
I do too. I love that.
But just briefly, chortle, as we've discussed in past episodes, is a portmanteau. And it's one of my favorite examples of said portmanteau.
Chuckle and what? Snort?
Chuckle and snort.
Chuckle
That's
and snort.
It.
Hey, I've got a question for you too. What is a portmanteau exactly? Let's put it that way.
I thought it was when you take two words and smash them together and make a third word that's different from the original two words.
Exactly.
Okay, so then is breakfast a portmanteau?
No, I just thought it was like a compound word.
Very good. That's the difference.
Yay!
We have breakfast because that's just a compound word. Break and fast.
Right.
Both of them are full words. But we have brunch.
Right.
Brunch is a portmanteau because we're clipping when we cut off one or two of the words.
Yeah, and we make a
third word. So when they're cut off and mushed together, that, then they're portmanteaus.
Mm. See, now if it were blunch, though, would it technically be a portmanteau because you still have the full word lunch in there?
It has to be one word, I believe. So would blunch, I like blunch. Brunch is like earlier, and then lunch is a little bit later.
Brunch is just right before lunch.
Yes.
I can have a second Bloody Mary at brunch.
I love brunch. I'm going to start using that. Sunday brunch.
Okay. This one, I think we've discussed this, but I'm not sure. Factoid was coined by Norman Mailer. Now, what was the original meaning?
Okay, right. So a factoid originally, and some people insist it still should be this way, even though clearly that's not true. Originally, a factoid was like a made-up fact, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
You got it.
Yeah. Now we just say it's like just a little fun fact.
A little mini
right?
fact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To me, the problem with that is I'm with you. I think it's silly. A factoid is like a factette, you know, a factini or something. I don't care what Norman Mailer thought at the time. It's like it's so used to mean the one thing. I think it's foolish to keep insisting, you know, on purity.
I actually agree with you. But I mean, because oid means resembling, but not the same. But you can even kind of mish it there into anything anyway. Because in a weird way, resembling but not the same, like a mini fact is sort of like a fact, but it's so small it's not really a good fact. I don't know.
I mean, what you just said, Kathy, is actually true, that it's foolish to insist it needs to be the way it was originally because no one takes it that way now. And if you're talking about a factoid, basically everybody is going to think you're talking about a little fact.
It's
They're not going to think you're talking about a made-up fact.
Precisely. And if we're using language to communicate well, it's you got it. I mean, I don't want someone thinking my little factoid is fake. I agree completely.
I'm sorry, that sounded very funny.
This one is a really interesting one, actually. Co-ed. Which is short for, you know, is this used that much anymore? I'm curious about this.
No.
I don't think it would be at all.
Co-ed.
Because we had it short for co-education. But, and it used to, and it sort of shows the misogyny of the past because it was used as a female student. Anyway, let's just quickly do this one anyway. Was this first used in 1925, F. Scott Fitzgerald's story, The Diamond as Big as the Ritz? 1886, Louisa May Alcott, Joe's Boys? 1755, Samuel Johnson.
In a dictionary of the English language.
Right. Just as a shortened version of co-educational or to mean...
We're talking about it as co-educational.
Okay. Johnson writing his dictionary doesn't seem right. Fitzgerald doesn't seem right. So I guess I'll go with Alcott right in the middle there.
And it does have a little misogynist ring to it in a way. She wrote it in Joe's Boys... The little guy, Adolphus Dolly Pettingill, says, never liked co-ed. objecting to eating with girls.
Mm.
So even the beginning of it is that way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's go to this one, which is fun. Which word was invented by Czech writer Karel Čapek, or Kopek, as a term for mechanized people?
Yes, I already know the answer, but go ahead.
Take the wind out of our sails, huh?
No, we're not. Automaton, mechanoid, animatron.
Oh, you got you gave me, you didn't give me robot.
No, I did it. I did that to
you got me mad.
You got me angry, Fletcher. Yeah, yeah, your robot is the right word. I wanted to give you a little bit of a zing, though.
Yeah, that was good. You almost got me there. But yeah, I know it's robot, and I think the play it came from is, I don't, is it a word or is it initials? R-U-R?
Yes.
Rossum's Universal Robots.
Oh, so it is.
Yep.
It
robots.
Is, did you say robots?
Yeah, I did, because I was thinking of Lost in Space.
Is that where they say robot? I hear people say, I hear sometimes people say, and more now these days, people are saying robot. And I feel like they're just trying to be cute, but I'm hearing it way more than I ever used to.
I'm going
to
keep my ears peeled. Because, that was Lost in Space. Billy Mumy, as Will Robinson, would call the robot. We would say something, where's the robot? He would remember.
Really?
This?
I never noticed that. That's interesting.
Oh, yeah.
I never noticed that.
Do the sub question, though. It's extra credit.
Oh, that's right. Here's it. Who took the word robot and ran with it by inventing the words robotic and robotics?
Oh, I just have to answer that. How about Asimov?
Fletcher, you are no robot in our book. You got it. Or you're an advanced robot. A high-functioning robot.
You'll never know.
Okay.
The word is scaredy cat. It means now a timid person or a coward.
Yeah.
When it was initially used, it was also just meant scared. Who first used it in print? Others might have used it in language. One, Dr. Seuss or Sois, as we know. Two, Dorothy Parker. Three, Lewis Carroll.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, it doesn't seem weird enough for Lewis Carroll. Who was the first one?
Dr. Seuss.
Oh, no. It's not him either. It doesn't seem quite sharp enough for Dorothy Parker, but I'll go with Dorothy Parker.
Oh, yes, do let's dance together. It's so nice to meet a man who isn't scaredy cat about catching my berry. That's pretty sharp, I think.
You're right.
Once you
put it all together there, you're absolutely right. Wow.
It's funny because 1933 seems much older than I would have expected when I think of the word scaredy cat, but in other ways, I see it as that sort of slangy, jazzy time, you know?
Although, interestingly enough, in etymology, I just looked up, they have an etymology thing. They're saying it's from 1906.
Scaredy cat?
Yes, and Dorothy Parker was definitely not around in 1906 doing it.
Well, she would have been furious if we said she were.
Yeah, I think she would.
Okay, now, OED has it as Dorothy Parker.
I know. I checked them, too. But the Etymology Online has Scaredy Cat as from 1906, which is interesting. And interestingly enough, they go backwards to a similar. Here we go again with our useful knowledge. Fraidy Cat, which they said is from 1871.
Oh, okay.
American English slang from frayed by 1816, dialectical African West Indies, pronunciation of afraid and then cat. Perhaps in reference to the animal's instinct to scatter when startled. Then they have Scaredy Cat is from 1906. And I'm looking desperately to find out someone in 1906 who said Scaredy Cat. And I can't find anything.
No, nor I. I see a lot of fraidy cats.
Lots of fraidy cats, but no scaredy cat.
When you say them enough, they both sound kind of silly, don't they?
They definitely do. Well, I think they're meant to be. I mean, they're not
scaredy
like...
Scaredy cat. How long has it been since either of you have called anyone a scaredy cat? It must have been...
here we go back again to, like, useless etymologies. I don't think I've ever used it since, you know, like I was 10 or something.
Yeah.
That old, I'm surprised.
Although, wait a minute, I just looked at, although interestingly enough, I'm looking right here at the Merriam-Webster, and they have an ad, this kitty is cautious, but not necessarily a scaredy cat, 2025, February, Contrasting the scaredy cat teams, Roseman sees the whole NFL marketplace as a potential roster building resource.
Then well, we that's have USA different, Today. Though, than you calling them someone a scaredy cat.
USA Today,
and if
Kevin...
If you're writing an article about hockey or something, you might say scaredy cat.
But... So. Well, it's NFL, too, Kathy. Football
oh,
as well.
I'm sorry. I didn't know what we were talking about there. Anyway, Dorothy gets my vote. I'm not buying this whatever. Because, I mean, the berry made it for me.
Well, I have lectures on the principles and practices of medicine. It's a doggone nightmare, said the scaredy cat.
So. No, no.
No.
Oh, okay.
I think we're enough.
This is someone after my own heart now. Now we're talking.
You're Saying It Wrong is part of the NPR network and is produced in the studios of KMUW in Wichita, Kansas, by me, Fletcher Powell. Kathy Petrus records from her home in Armilla, Spain. Ross Petrus from his home in Toronto, Ontario, in Canada. Torrin Anderson composed our theme music, and our digital team is Beth Golay, Kate Hutchins, and Carly Cooper. You can find all of our past episodes by subscribing to the You're Saying It Wrong podcast wherever you get your podcasts, or by visiting us at kmuw.org. If you have a question for Kathy and Ross, if you'd like to suggest a topic, or you just want to reach out, you can email me at powell@kmuw.org or email them at kandrpetrus@gmail.com. You can also email us a voice memo of you asking it your question. You might get your voice heard on air. If you'd like to do the same thing by downloading the KMUW app, you can do that and just click the Talk to Us button. You can find all of Kathy and Ross's books pretty much anywhere you get books, and a handful of them are also available on audiobook, read by the authors themselves. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.